tonight. Can you hear me okay at the back? Yeah.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I have a sore throat actually. I was at a football match the other night, you know, and I didn't say which football match I was at, but my throat's very sore, so I do need the mic. The first thing I'd like to do is to thank the organisers of the DUP for the invite to address you today. Winston and Billy have asked. I was involved with some colleagues in making a slight contribution to this document, which some of you have seen, which I commend to you to read. It's an excellent document, an excellent contribution to the broader debate on dealing with the past. And we launched this at an epic event a number of weeks ago, and Winston and Billy asked me to come along and basically do a backdrop to the panel discussion on the Stromatos Agreement and what's in it in terms of dealing with the past, and then what's in or likely to be in the legislation that's coming, basically that's implementing the dealing with the past elements of the Stromatos Agreement. Before I do that, I wanted to make two interrelated preliminary points. The first is on the role of ex-combatants. Ex-combatants were heavily involved in the production of this, and with my colleague, formerly of Queen's, now the Honourable Pete Sherlow, I've done a lot of work over the years looking at researching and writing about the role that ex-combatants have played in the transition from conflict in Northern Ireland. And we've never made the argument that all ex-combatants are saints. That's not the approach. But we have felt it important to document the heavy lifting in the peace process that ex-combatants have done. A lot of it very unglamorous. Ex-combatants have provided conspicuous leadership in challenging cultures of violence through, for example, the exemplary work of Northern Ireland Alternatives and Community Restorative Justice Ireland, both involved in restorative justice work, but more broadly at interface areas and a whole range across the piece. Ex-combatants have done a lot of work, heavy lifting work, on dealing with the legacy of violence. And once again, they're going to be asked to contribute once again. They'll be asked to provide leadership once again in terms of dealing with the past. And the second is to loyalists in particular, loyalists across the piece, not just the ex-combatants. The flaw in the political process that led to the Stormont House Agreement is that loyalists weren't around the table. If you were sitting down to design the dealing with the past mechanism, you would have had loyalists around that table contributing to the conversation, and contributing to the debate, and contributing to the way in which the architecture was shaped. That didn't happen. When we were speaking about that at the EPIC event, Winston actually put it very nicely. If in stark terms, he said, we have a stark choice. We can either cry in our beer, or we can take part in this conversation. And that's, I think that's where we're at. I mean, obviously, lawyers have been involved in having conversations within the constituency. But there will be a process now of about 6 months once this legislation is introduced in Westminster. There hasn't been a proper consultation, a proper public consultation on the legislation. And loyalists will have to be part of that conversation and make your voices heard. Because as I said at that epic event a couple of weeks ago, if you don't make your voice heard, and if you don't contribute to the narrative of dealing with the past, someone else will do it for you. That's the reality of it. Someone else will write your narrative for you. And so it's very much echoing what Peter was saying earlier on. If you're not there making your voices heard, someone else is going to write the narrative for you. So in terms of the broader picture on dealing with the past, as everybody knows, the Good Friday Agreement didn't have an overarching mechanism for dealing with the past. And what we've had as a result of that has been a quite unsatisfactory piecemeal approach to dealing with the past. So we've had public inquiries, as Bloody Sunday and the Curry inquiries. We've had the Silver Review into Finucane. We've had police-led historical inquiry team. We've had the work of the Ombudsman on police-related allegations of malfeasance during the conflict, inquests, civil action, prosecution, a whole range of things happening, but no one thinks that it's working. No one, and obviously that, we've had four basic attempts to pull it all together. The first was an NGO-inspired thing that Healing to Remembering did in 2006. We had the work of the consultative group on the past. I saw Leslie Carroll was in the audience, and that group did, from my perspective, some excellent work on dealing with the past. As we know, it all got derailed about the £12,000 payment. We had the Hansard Sullivan negotiations, and then we had the Stormont House Agreement. And so for the last number of years, myself and a number of colleagues have been involved in processes, trying to help the process, in effect, trying to help all of the political actors. So we've briefed all of the political parties involved in the negotiations, but also to help civil society. These are very complex and sensitive issues, and people have very diverse views on them. But we thought that we could provide some technical expertise. We do a lot of work both here and internationally on dealing with the past. And basically, let people come to their own view on it, but to do so from an informed position. So for the last number of years, we've produced lots of briefing documents on issues like amnesties and truth recovery and prosecutions, all of that stuff, engaging with ex-prisoners groups, former security force personnel, victims groups, right across the piece, basically letting people make up their own mind from an informed position. And so when the Stormont House Agreement was concluded in December 2014, we decided to do our version of the draft legislation to see what it would look like. I think from past experiences, we had learned that in the space between the doing of the deal and the implementing of the legislation, there's a lot of slips between lip and cup on that. Certainly on the policing debate, historically, a number of us felt we'd taken our eye off the ball, and then we're always playing catch up when the first iteration of policing legislation was introduced. So we sat down using the framework of the Stormont House Agreement and have drafted our own legislation. And we've tried to be as rigorous as possible in doing that. It's colleagues at the Committee on Administration of Justice, myself, and colleagues at the University of Ulster, and the other person involved, as the guy called Jeremy Hill. Jeremy Hill was the legal advisor to the consultative group in the past. He's a former Foreign and Commonwealth Office lawyer, very experienced diplomat and lawyer. And so what we were trying to do was to be as disciplined as we could in the writing of it. And so just taking what was in the agreement and turning that into legislation. But it's not some kind of utopian wish list, it's what's in the Act. So there are four elements to the Stormont House Agreement in terms of dealing with the PAT. I'm going to zip through them very quickly and give you a sense of where I think things are at. First is the Historical Investigations Unit. Second is the Independent Commission on Information Retrieval. Third is a body called the Implementation Reconciliation Group. And the fourth is a mechanism called the Oral History Archive. In broad terms, what you see there is a disaggregated way of trying to deal with the past. In other societies, obviously, people have set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. For political reasons, I suppose, and the nature of our society, that's not the way we've done this. So we have a disaggregated, with a series of interlocking in some ways over mechanisms trying to deal with this. So the Historical Investigations Unit. The HIU, as envisaged in the Stormont House Agreement, is an amalgamation of the work previously done by the Historical Inquiries Team and the past-related work of the Office of the Police Ombudsman. So it's a police-led, the idea is a police-led investigation, or at least experienced investigators gathering evidence. If sufficient evidence is there to achieve a prosecution, then that evidence gets passed to the Public Prosecution Service and prosecutions are pursued. As we all know, anybody convicted as a result of that for a conflict-related offence pre-1998 was served a maximum of 2 years, right? So that's one element of what the HIU will do. The other element will be the production of reports in a similar fashion as the HET did to the families affected, subject to right-to-life issues in terms of the state's responsibility to protect right-to-life, but information contained in those reports is designed to help bring closure to assist families come to terms with what happened. So first, on the first element of that, the prosecution part of it, it's important to stress that both legally and practically, it is extremely difficult to successfully achieve prosecutions for historical or related events. We've had a number of successful prosecutions, but any lawyer, any police officer will tell you from the get-go, it's extremely difficult to do this. And Hugh Ord, who was the man behind setting up the HET, was always, I think, very honest and very frank, particularly in terms of engaging with victims on this issue. Hugh Ord, I'll quote him here, it's a lengthy quote, but it's useful, I think. He said this: the likelihood of solving cases, this is in terms of the HET, but read across to the HIU, the likelihood of solving cases is clearly going to be slight. Witnesses would be old or dead. Exhibits, if still available, could be contaminated or inadmissible. Informants and agents would be in the mix. The original paperwork incomplete or missing. At the height of the troubles, 497 people were murdered in 1 year. The forensic lab was blown up twice. Numerous police stations were blown up, stations housing much of the investigative material. We had to shift the focus to ensure that, mindful of our primary role as investigators, the driving force behind this initiative would be to deliver a meaningful outcome for families, right? So that's Hugh Ward, in his own unique fashion, being very honest and very frank, I think, about the realities of prosecution. And that really what he's saying is that, mindful of their responsibilities as investigators, there's another emphasis here, and that emphasis is the production of the materials that's designed to bring closure to families. The reports, basically, are the key for that, right? For the vast majority of families, they're never going to see anyone prosecuted for what happened. The vast majority of families, and anyone who tells victims different than that, I think is being irresponsible. I think I think there's a responsibility for all of us in public life in this part to manage victims' expectations responsibly. And so anyone who is saying to victims there are going to be lots and lots of successful prosecutions as a result of the work of HIU is being, in my view, irresponsible. So in the Stormont House Agreement, the United Kingdom government made an unequivocal commitment to full disclosure to the HIU. There was no national security or other qualification to that commitment made in the terms of the agreement. Now, as many of you will have seen the draft legislation proposed by the government leaked last week. It's now come into the public domain, and there's been a lot of comment on it. I spent a day and a half nerding away, reading the thing, cover to cover. A better lawyer probably could have read it in 2 hours. It took me a day and a half to figure out what was in the thing and what it meant. And I'm still in that process, as are my colleagues. So this is it's a work in progress. It's a complex piece of work. Right. So what I see in the HIU at the minute from the draft is that on the one hand, there is a powerful investigative mechanism being created there. There's significant onus on public authorities to provide information to the HIU. And you can see the prosecutorial investigative element of the HIU looks pretty good to me. It looks quite strong, and you can see that you may get some results. I don't think you'll get many results, as I said earlier, but that part of it, the investigative element of the HIU, as we see in the draft leaked legislation, looks quite strong. Where we're coming up short significantly from my perspective is the second part, and arguably the more important part, which is the part about the information that is provided to families as a result of those investigations. I said, take as read, there aren't going to be mass prosecutions. It's the onward information, what's called onward disclosure. What we see in that is, contrary to what's in the agreement, we see a raft of mechanisms that are around national security and basically allowing state bodies, be it police, MI5 or others, to exclude information that will be provided to families. Right now, national security isn't in the agreement, but it's all over. It's all over the leaked draft. There's a clause in there, I'll give you two examples. There's a clause in there that says, this is clause 21A, the HIU must not do anything in carrying out its functions which would or would be likely to prejudice the national security interests of the United Kingdom. That is so vague and so obviously objectionable. I think that's only in there to be offered up as a compromise down the line. It doesn't make any sense otherwise. It's as vague that you think, why would you put that in? That's so all over the shop. I was trying to look at other mechanisms, see if you use anything like it. I can't find anything analogous to that anywhere else. There's a new system, proposed in the leaked legislation, which will allow basically a public authority to stamp something as having sensitive information. My reading is that if anything is stamped, can it then be passed on to the families, right? Now, the involvement, for example, of state agents in murder is pretty sensitive, one would have thought, on the face of it. What that means in practical terms, if I'm reading it correctly, is that, for example, as has now been illustrated by the Prime Minister, David Cameron, and we know that state agents were involved at all stages in the murder of Pat Finucane, right? If the HIU were doing an investigation under these mechanisms, I'm not sure Geraldine Finucane would ever have known there were state agents involved in the killing of Pat Finucane. Cases where families, for example, the Cloudy Bomb or King's Mill or other families where Republican terrorists were involved in violence, I don't think the families would ever find out. From my reading of this, I'm not sure families would ever, in the new shiny HIU, I'm not sure families would ever get the level of information that is required in terms of information recovery, subject to the state's responsibility to protect Article 2 at all under the new mechanism. That's a serious flaw. That holds the credibility of that institution below the waterline. Now, this is a draft, and this is technical stuff. And so, it's politics as well. People are putting a draft out, maybe see what will fly, see what the reaction will be. But I can't see that one flying politically at all. The other bits, right, I'm going to be very quickly here, like 3 more minutes, is that all right, Malachi? Yeah. The other elements of it, the Independent Commission for Information Retrieval, we haven't seen the draft legislation that was leaked last week doesn't contain the sections on this. This requires, legislation also requires an international treaty between the British and Irish governments and required something being introduced in Dublin as well. That mechanism basically is based on the Disappeared Commission, and the idea is to allow victims to get information in private, although the information then is passed on to the victim's family. But the person providing that information cannot be prosecuted or cannot be held civilly liable for that information provided. It's the same mechanism, basically. There's been a lot of hot air in the press about that this is an amnesty. This is really not an amnesty. This is a very limited form of immunity. Any information coming about any person who's been involved in past violence They won't be protected by the fact that they've engaged in that process. It's just the information that's provided in that process itself. So if you have forensic evidence or other evidence that's found elsewhere, it doesn't protect anyone. This is really not an amnesty. It is it's as British as Finchley, to be honest. I went back and looked at this mechanism, this style of mechanism. And one of the things I think particularly for unionists sometimes can be, if you sell something as, this is Fancy Dan, transitional justice, this is South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission, amnesty, etc., it makes people run, particularly the TUP and the official unions. Actually, what's this style of mechanism, this form of limited immunity? This is the kind of guarantee that is given in public inquiries on train crashes. It is, you know, it's the same kind of guarantee of non-prosecution that is given for public inquiries going right back to the 1960s. So it isn't Fancy Dan transitional justice. It's pretty essentially, it's a guarantee of non-prosecution for engagement with the mechanism. Okay, the last two wee bits, the Oral History Archive is a way for, it's a mechanism for people to locate their stories. I think that potentially could be a very interesting mechanism. The significant issue with it in the draft legislation at the moment is its relationship with the Public Records Office in Northern Ireland, which reports up to DECAL. Basically, it's not independent enough, long story short, at the moment. But that's something that can be fixed. I think you can design governance structures that give that mechanism the kind of independence that's required in order to generate public trust. The last one, which is very important, is a mechanism called the Implementation and Reconciliation Group. The Implementation and Reconciliation Group mechanism that was agreed, basically, it'll have political nominees on the governance structure, and then you have a group of academics involved in writing big theme, big picture stuff about what happened during the conflict. And the appointees, the political appointees to that mechanism, are on the Dahan principle. So, you know, it's three TUP, two Sinn Féin, one representative from each of the government, etc., etc. At the moment, the government's position is that doesn't need to be in the legislation. I think our view, and those of us who've been working this for a while, is that that's a mistake. Basically, if we allow this in a mechanism that's going to be probably dominated by DUP and Sinn Féin, it won't happen, basically. It won't happen unless it's got a strong legislative basis to make it happen. I think that will struggle to get off the ground at all. So we'll be making the argument very strongly that also needs to be included in the legislation. Okay, I'll finish here. So as I say, when the legislation is published in full, there'll be about a 6-month process of a public conversation about how we're going to deal with the past. If we were starting in a different place, my own view is that we should have been cleverer earlier in finding structural and political ways to accommodate and hear and listen to the voice of loyalism, but we are where we are. We'll help if we can. We've made this offer to everybody across the piece. If people are involved in conversations within their own constituencies and they need help on the technical aspects of this, we'll do that. We for anybody across the piece, we'll do that, and then people make up their own mind, and we continue to do that. There's a website with all of this stuff on it. Once again, however, we're going to need leadership. We're going to need leadership and sensible voices. And in the past, the PUP has been a key sensible voice in the middle of a lot of noise and this. And a sensible voice is going to be required again. As your former party leader, David Rowrett, once said, we all suffer, but only by recognising that each of us has a responsibility to do something about it will we make change. Thank you very much for your attention.